It is my distinct pleasure to introduce our main speaker, Mary Ann from Santa Monica.
Good evening, everybody. I'm Mary Ann, and I'm an alcoholic. And it's very nice to be here. I want to thank the group for inviting me to be here tonight. And it's nice to see old friends, some of the people who have moved over here from Southern California, who I've known then, and a fellow that I used to work with is here tonight, and I'm always glad to see him. I remember when he started talking about going to meetings, I thought, oh, I just know that kid's not going to make it. He's just probably trying to get the heat off or something. And it's 10 years later, and I couldn't be happier to have been wrong about Mike. So I'm very grateful to be here. This is a nice evening, and I'll tell you, in all seriousness, any time that I can come to Las Vegas and conduct myself with a little bit of dignity is a distinct and decided pleasure, because this guy was talked about pushing a cart down Fremont Street, and I always say, I'm just so glad that I'm not running down Fremont Street with my dress up over my head. And I was looking over some of you white-haired guys to see if there is any old friends here. Because I haven't always been a respectable elderly lady with a limp. I'm very glad to be here tonight. My sobriety date is August 4th, 1969. I'm very grateful for that. And I didn't know when I was doing it that it was going to be 35 years. I didn't know what I thought. I woke up on the morning of August 4th in 1969, and I felt bad, but I'd felt bad for a long time. I had embarrassed myself the night before, but I'd been embarrassing myself for 29 years, drunk and sober. But there was something different that day. For whatever reason, I had a sense of despair and kind of an emptiness. There was nothing I could think of that I could do to fix the condition I was in. And I knew that I couldn't continue living any longer the way that I was living. And I didn't know what I was going to do, so I did what I've always done. I went to work, because I have been crazy most of my life, but I have always, by God, held down a job. And sometimes I had bad jobs and did them poorly, but I've always had a job. So it was just customary for me to go to work no matter what kind of shape I was in. And I was working at a restaurant in West Los Angeles called Pix. And I was cleaning off a table in that restaurant, and the thought occurred to me, why don't you try AA? And I haven't had anything to drink, and I haven't taken any psychiatric medication from that day to this. I took a gallon of Thorazine in the county hospital here. I might as well talk a little bit about my drinking from the standpoint of living here in Las Vegas, because I packed quite a bit into 2 years. And the part of it that is always, because it does sort of show the progression. I was born and brought up in the Middle West, and I was kind of an odd kid, and I always wanted to be a movie star and, you know, all that sort of thing. But I didn't drink until I was 18 years old, and I didn't become a movie star. I went off to a hairdressing academy. I had to get in the bathroom tonight and scrape my fingers through my hair and wad it up and tie it up, because I'm not that, you know, you can see about how interested in hair I am, you know. But I didn't know what else to do with myself, and I was out of high school, and I didn't get discovered for the movies, so I had to go to hairdressing school for something to do. And I went off there, and I started to drink then. I was invited out one night by people who were a little bit older than I was, and they were drinking, so I drank. And I went from being somebody out for the evening to what the book describes an alcoholic to be, and that is very rarely mildly intoxicated, always more or less insanely drunk. And I went from a young girl out for the evening to a drunken, crazy woman in mid-swallow somewhere. I don't know when. And even when I was doing it, I knew that my behavior was wrong, objectionable, and I couldn't stop. So right from the very beginning, I was powerless. And the next day when I came to, I was as sick and as embarrassed as I'd ever been in my life. I was so ashamed. And I shuffled off to that beauty academy to try to put in a day's work. And one of the fellows that was there that was a little bit older said to me, you know, I heard about the way you acted last night when you were drinking, and maybe you're one of those people who just shouldn't drink. And I said, yes, but. So right from the beginning, I'm defending my right to drink. There's a line in the third chapter paragraph that's read at some meetings that says that somehow, someday, he will learn to control and enjoy his drinking is the great obsession of every abnormal drinker. And I certainly ascribe to that theory, because From the beginning, I couldn't have said it that way, but from the very beginning, there was something that alcohol did for me that I needed to have done, and I knew that there had to be a way that I could get that wonderful feeling that alcohol gave me without having to pay that terrible penalty of the disgrace and the humiliation of being completely out of control. I fought that, you know, to the gates of insanity or death. I drank back in Iowa, and I worked in beauty parlors for a little while, I became kind of wild and crazy, but also terribly remorseful. So I was either drinking, thinking about drinking, or petitioning the higher powers for relief from the sins of my drinking. My whole life started to revolve around alcohol, so there was really nothing much I could do with my life. I went back home and lived with my parents for a while. I don't suppose I'm the only person in this room who has had to make a fresh start. I was only 19 or 20, 21 when I came home to live with the folks. And one night my dad was waiting up for me, and he said, "You can live any way you want to, but if you're going to be here at home with us, you have to live in such a way that you don't embarrass us." So I quit drinking for a while because I knew I couldn't drink and not embarrass people. Even at 21, I knew that. And I decided, I'm a person that doesn't know the difference between a fantasy and a plan. I will create a fantasy, and then I'll make some perfectly practical plans to go along with it. It's just idiotic. And I decided right then that I wanted to be in show business. And I didn't think, I'm not a city girl. I grew up in a town of 8,500 people. I'd been to Chicago once on my high school class trip, and my idea, I'd lived in Cedar Rapids for a while, and I thought when I lived in Cedar Rapids, I was a city girl. So I knew that I couldn't get along in a big city and navigating alone. But Las Vegas during the early 60s was very exciting, but it was also a small, I believe, now memory may not serve, but it seems to me that Las Vegas was not a very big town at that time. Very exciting, but not very big. So I decided to move to Las Vegas, and I would get a job in the chorus line, and some movie producer from Hollywood would be in Las Vegas and see me in that chorus line and see something about me and pluck me out of that chorus line and turn me into a movie star. And ladies and gentlemen, I started saving my money and preparing to follow that plan, and I did it. I got on August 15th, the day of the Feast of the Assumption, I went to Mass and Holy Communion and got on a bus and came out to Las Vegas. 3 days after I got here, I started drinking again. 2 months after I started drinking, I was in the county hospital mental facility taking Thorazine. And I can assure you that if emotional problems were what was wrong with me, it would have been solved. And there was a very wonderful, caring psychiatrist that was seeing people at the county hospital then. And he took an interest in me. And I knew the minute, from the day I met him, I knew that he understood me. People have been trying to help me all my life. My folks, I wasn't raised by wolves. My parents tried very hard to be kind to me, and I had a Catholic education, and you can say what you want to about the nuns and priests, but you can't say they're not interested. They try to help, and I'd had employers that were kind to me. Employers that even when I wasn't very good at what I was doing, they had seen a potential in me and had tried to help me. Nothing. And I never could convince myself that anybody really knew what was wrong with me. I knew there was something wrong with me, and I knew I didn't know what it was, but I knew nobody else understood either. But this psychiatrist, may he rest in peace, he's been dead many years now, seemed to understand me right from the beginning. But you know, and I even took some of the suggestions that he gave me, and yet I didn't drink a drop less, because I'll tell you something, there's always going to come a day when alcohol is going to be what I need. There's something that alcohol does for me that I simply have to have done. Eventually it became to be a daily basis, but at that time, there were times when I could go without drinking, but there's always going to come a time that it doesn't matter what kind of a price I have to pay for drinking, I'm going to do it. And I worked down on Fremont Street. I had a job the whole time I worked, the whole time I lived here. I only was able to last for 2 years, but I gave it everything I had. I worked down on Fremont in a little place called the Club Bingo. I was a bingo caller and collected the bingo money. And I liked that job, and the people liked me, and it was wonderful. But I drank, and I got into trouble. And I got into more trouble than I got into back in Iowa. I've always had a hard time keeping a grip on myself when I'm drinking, and I'll just do almost anything when I'm drunk and chase after people that I don't know and get myself involved in mixed company. There's some stories I could tell you that, I mean, they wouldn't necessarily curl your hair, because I don't think I'm alone in some of these endeavors, but I have done things that I just cringe now when I think about some of the stuff that I did, some of the the truly bizarre situations that I put myself in, and really came out of it pretty lucky, because I was mixed up sometimes with some people that were a little on the rough side, but I came out of it relatively unscathed until in 1965 I had taken up with a fella that I never did like, but I always had to have somebody around, and he was the only one available at that time, and he sort of liked me, and I latched onto him, and then I was... Well, never mind, but it was really awful, and I was starting to get scared. So I left town in 1965. I left town to get away from him, as much the same as I had left Cedar Rapids to get away from another man. He wasn't dangerous. This guy from Cedar Rapids wasn't dangerous, but it was just a bad, tawdry situation, and I had to leave to get away from it, because I'm not one of these people that can rise above myself and say, this is wrong, it has to stop. I've got to physically take myself away, and I had to get away from this guy because I was starting to really get scared of him. And I knew, you know, I don't know about any of the rest of you ladies here, but I know this about me, or even you guys: if there's going to be a crazy person in the relationship, I want it to be me. I want to be accepted as I am, but I certainly don't want to have to put up with any of your foolishness. And so anyway, I left Las Vegas under cover of darkness and came over to Southern California, and I've lived in Santa Monica since 1965. And I drank for 4 more years, and I got into jackpots in Southern California. But like the book says, sometimes we have these brief periods of recovery. Now, brief periods of recovery is kind of a relative term. In other words, I never really stopped drinking, but I would have periods of time where my behavior wouldn't be so bizarre, where the comfort that alcohol gave me was enough that I wouldn't have to put on a performance, too. I don't know how to describe it, but I'd have some periods of time when I could just drink and have it do what I wanted it to do for me. It would calm my nerves down, make me feel a part of things, make me not worry, let me let go of my worries and cares. Because one thing alcohol did for me from the day I took it, the first drink, to the last drink I had, there was always a period in any drinking episode that I ever had where there would be a brief flurry of my feeling at one with the universe. And that's the only way I could ever get it. But I could get it. I can't remember a time when I drank that I didn't have some feeling of that. And so I had to drink. And on August 4th of 1969, like I said, I woke up ashamed and embarrassed. I'd met a man. I'd always had to have some man hanging around, or I'd go hang around some man. That was the way it was. And really, I never really wanted to get married and have children. I pretended that I did in order not to appear too grotesque, but I never really had. But I always had to have a man around, or hang around, hang around some guy, because I didn't. I just felt. That seemed to, I don't know what I thought, but it was just, it made me, if I felt that I was in any way alluring, I also felt that I was worthwhile. And I don't know how to describe it, but that's as close as I can get. But anyway, I had finally met someone that I fell in love with in a way that I'd never been in love before. I wanted to marry him, and I wanted to have a family. And he also liked me at the same time I liked him, which... we were actually on the same page for a while. But what happened was my drinking took that last irreversible turn, which makes me realize that alcoholism really, in my case, and it seems like the case of a lot of us, all of us perhaps in this room, my alcoholism cannot be treated by finding happiness or true love or even getting away from bad situations. No matter, as long as I continue to drink, I will be unavoidably on a spiral going down, that it will always, I may have brief moments, but it'll always spiral down farther. And the last day that I drank was not the worst drunk that I've ever been on, but it was the one that rendered me absolutely helpless, because I became so very much aware that I simply had no answer. And so when I went to work that day, and that voice in my head said, why don't you try AA? I didn't give it another thought until I went home that afternoon from work. And I was walking up the stairs toward my apartment. I said to myself, if I'm going to go to AA tonight, I won't go over to Pete's this afternoon. Now, I had gone over to Pete's Wilshire House every afternoon of my life for quite a while. I lived right across the street from Pete's because I had to drink, and I had to drink in the company of other drinkers. I don't know when I stopped drinking if I even had any booze in the refrigerator because I'd become so frantic and so terrified all the time. And this boyfriend had left me, and I was all alone. I had to drink, and I had to be out with others. The only time I could be alone was when I was passed out. And so I did not go over to Pete's Wilshire House. I called Alcoholics Anonymous and found out where a meeting was that night that I could get to. I then called my parents back in Iowa and told them that I was going to go to AA. I said, I believe I have a drinking problem. I'm going to try to do something about it. And I believe I'm going to try to go to an AA meeting tonight. I was not sure, but I knew once I told my folks I'd have to do it. Because unlike some people, there was nobody, not even the people I drank with, who wanted me to continue drinking. You know, there was I'm one of those kind of people, I can embarrass other drunk people. You know, so I sort of made a commitment. I didn't know I was making a commitment, but that's what I was doing. And the thing that I remember about that afternoon is one thing only, and that is that I don't remember anything, but I do know this, I didn't drink, I didn't take any pills, and I didn't get scared. And I had been having terrible attacks of panic and anxiety every day. And I had to drink because that's the only way I could get away from them. Nothing. I could not drink enough. I got a prescription of Thorazine on the street one time. I mean, the doctor was prescribing it. And I was taking a bottle of it a day. And that wouldn't, all it did was make me sluggish. It wasn't calming me down. If you can't calm down drinking a bottle of Thorazine, believe me, you're nervous. And Valium and Librium were big deals in those days, and I had a prescription for Librium, and I'd been seeing another psychiatrist, and he'd prescribed Librium for me, and I took that until it made the back of my head numb, and I decided that was not an answer, so I continued to drink. But that day I didn't drink, and I didn't get scared. And I went to the meeting that night, and I don't remember much about it. I do remember that when they asked for alcoholics and newcomers, that my hand got pushed up and that I started to shake real bad. I'm sure it was a combination of nerves and anxiety, but I didn't feel anxious. I just started physically vibrating. And I said, oh, this is ridiculous. I didn't drink that much. And fortunately for me, I was in a meeting where nobody took my shaking too seriously. This was in 1969. A lot of the old-timers would have been drinkers in the Depression, and people were still talking, when I was newly sober, people were still talking about stuff like Jamaica ginger and stuff, and and something called Jake leg, which I suppose made you walk like the way I walk now, but anyway, so there's some hard drinking people there, and I guess a 29-year-old girl who otherwise looked reasonably healthy doing a little bit of shaking didn't scare them too bad. And so I eventually quit shaking, and I sat there, and at the end of the meeting, they took me up to the literature table and gave me some literature, and somebody gave me a ride home, and they told me to come back the next night. And I went to bed that night, but I took the literature with me, and I read some of it, and I was fascinated. I hadn't been able to read in a long time, but I was fascinated by that literature, and I went to sleep, and I woke up the next morning to the sound of the alarm clock, and I had not slept a night through, and I can't tell you how long. The first night I was sober, I slept the night through, and I went to work, and I went to a meeting the next night. And that was a participation meeting, and I was 48 hours sober. I was at my second AA meeting. I was at my first participation meeting, and I was about the second person they called on. And I got up to that lectern, and I said, my name is Mary Ann, and I'm an alcoholic, and I said a couple of sentences appropriate to the situation. Maybe I was a little bit, cynical or, ironic, but for the most part, I wasn't a snot, and I didn't make a spectacle of myself. And in 48 hours, AA was doing for me what nobody had been able to do, and that is to help me become kind of a part of things, in a small way at least, but a start. Because, I'd wanted to be a part of things all my life, but I knew that I couldn't. I knew there was something wrong with me, and I didn't know what it was, and nobody else seemed to know what it was, so I acted weird and pretended that's the way I wanted to be. And I didn't want to be odd or weird. I wanted to be a part of things. And one of the reasons that I wanted to be a movie star so bad was I thought that I had to have this really big life in order to feel normal. I was never able to go out on dates and stuff because it made me too nervous. But I thought, well, if I was a movie star, people would want to go out with me and I wouldn't be scared. And I was too nervous to drive a car. And I used to always think, well, if I'm a movie star, I'll be able to drive right around with a chauffeur. Nobody will think that's a goofy woman that can't drive a car. They'll just think there's that movie star being driven around by her chauffeur. You know, it was so much. I needed to have this great big life in order to feel just like a regular person. And I could not have given you that analogy when I was new and for many years. But I started to hear it in AA. I started to hear other people talk about the same things that I did. And I remember listening to a woman when I was 3 or 4 days sober talk about learning to drive a car. And I can remember running up to her and asking her if she thought that I would ever learn to drive a car. And she said, yes, I believe you will. And I did. I did eventually learn how to drive a car. I can remember another woman at a meeting one time saying, you can't get well in style. And I can remember just feeling this huge weight lifted off my shoulders because I knew that I was kind of strange, and I knew eventually I was going to do something goofy. And I was so afraid that, you know, I'd be sort of shunted out of here if everybody knew how really odd I was. And when she said, you can't get well in style, I took that to mean that I didn't have to. And so that was a tremendous relief. When I was brand new, a woman named Maish was very kind to me. May she rest in peace. She died a few years ago. But Maish helped me out and kind of encouraged me and told me I was doing the right thing. And I don't remember talking to her on the phone too much, but I do remember going to meetings with her. And then I started to sniff around the people that I'm still involved with today, the group that I still go to now. And I started to hang around them. And one night at a party that a woman named Nuan, may she rest in peace, she used to invite us over to her apartment in Santa Monica after the Saturday night meeting, so we'd all have a place to go. And a young woman named Alice sort of took me under her wing, and she hadn't been sober that much longer than I had, and her life was probably in a lot more, you know, problems, because she was married to a man I don't think she even spoke to, and she had a little kid that she was trying to raise, and I don't think he spoke to her either. I think it was sort of a mutually, you know, they loathed one another. And but anyway, so I know she had more troubles than I did, because I had a little job and a place to live and no problems. You know, my boyfriend was gone and I was on my own, and I was crazy, but I didn't have any real physical problems. But Alice took me under her wing, and she became my first acknowledged sponsor. And I wrote my first 4-step and took my first 5th step while Alice was my sponsor. And then gradually we started not to grow apart so much, although that was it, but she wanted to move on and go to a different meetings, and I wanted to stay put because I had become enamored of the Pacific group, and I wanted to stay right where I was. I liked the people, and I liked the way they did things, and I really wanted to be a part of it, so I stayed put. And then that's when I got Clancy to be my sponsor, and I started to do the things that he asked me to do, and I went to parties, and I even went to the yard for a while when I was fairly new. I'd always worked on the weekends, and I still worked, but I'd go over after work, and it was quite of a sacrifice for me to do it, because sometimes I'd have to take a taxi over there, because I didn't have a car, and I couldn't figure out I knew east-west bus routes, but I couldn't figure out a north-south bus route, so I just would take a taxi over there and play volleyball. And that was when they didn't have as many girls in the group, and so toward the end of the day, they'd take the girls on just as sort of, you know, as handicaps. You know, each team would have to take a couple of women. And one time, I was playing right beside a guy that was had been a football player for the San Francisco 49ers, and right across from me, a guy that had been on when Wisconsin had such big winning teams back in the Big Ten. And I can remember looking at those guys and saying, you will remember this is just a game, won't you? Because I was, you know, because they get so competitive, they forget about us girls and just push us out of the way or blast us, you know. Or another thing that those snots would do is they knew that we'd be scared, and they'd spike, if we were up in the front row, they'd spike that ball right at us. You know, all we could do was right there. So anyway, but I did all those things, and I wrote my first another inventory with and read it to Clancy. And I remember I called him up one day, and I was whining and crying about something, because I didn't change all that much right away. I didn't drink, I didn't take drugs, and I went to meetings, and I stayed away from my old haunts. I did that. I was fully enmeshed in AA, in the fellowship, and I was trying the best I could to work a program. But I was involved in yet another one of these illicit romances that I think, I know there's going to be a price on them, but it seems so wonderful at the time that when the tab comes due, I'm not going to mind paying it. And the tab had come due, and I was minding. And I was on whining to Clancy and whining. He said, it's time for you to learn how to drive a car. And I just didn't have anything to do with transportation. And I said, you know, I can't, you know, I've tried to learn to drive a car, Clancy, and I'm too nervous and high-strung. I can't. And he said, well, I think you're too crazy to decide what you can do and what you can't do. I think that's my job. And so I learned how to drive a car, and I'm very grateful for that, that I learned how to drive a car. And I remember three things he said to me that day. Now, I don't know whether he said them, but I certainly heard him say them. And that they were in this, in my memory, they are like, these are almost verbatim, and they were in this order. Now, whether he said this or not, I don't know, but I definitely heard it that day. You have to learn how to drive so you can give back what's been given to you, and you've certainly been given a lot of rides. You will feel more like a human being if you do more of the things that human beings do, and you will reach a degree of freedom that you never dreamed possible. Now, I don't know that he said them 1, 2, 3, but in that conversation, I remember those three things almost verbatim to what I said. And those things have all come true. I had been given a lot of rides, and I could see. I was able to see. Fortunately, the scales were lifted off my eyes, and I was, for somebody as self-absorbed as I was and to some extent still am today, I was very much able to see that the people who were making it were the people who were bestirring themselves to be of some use to others. That was the way to make it here, to have any kind of continued comfort in my life. I was going to have to bestir myself a little bit to be of some use to others. So I couldn't argue with that. When I heard that about feeling, you know, about human beings too, that was kind of a relief to me that he said that, because I thought, well, he must know how I feel about myself, that I'm not quite human. I look like a human being. I was certainly raised by human beings. I associate with human beings, but there's something a little bit not quite human about me. I didn't think I was an animal. I just thought there was something missing from me. There was just something missing. I just couldn't seem to make it. Like, there were so many things that other people could do that it was very difficult for me to do. And I can remember the reach a degree of freedom that I never dreamed possible. You know, I had to give somebody a ride one time. And I was so scared. I was just terrified. Oh, they just lived in Mar Vista. But I driving them from Santa Monica to Mar Vista, and then driving them from Mar Vista to Santa Monica and then back to Mar Vista, I was terrified, just terrified. But I got it done. I did it. And about 3 or 4 years later, I was in my car. It was 11 o'clock at night, and I was jumping on the 10 freeway, headed back to Northeast Iowa. I was going to drive cross-country by myself. And I was much less afraid than I was the night I went to Mar Vista. I was on my way to Iowa, and I wasn't nearly as afraid as I was the evening that I had to go to Mar Vista. So I'd certainly reached a degree of freedom that I'd never dreamed possible. I try to, and I'm going to wind this up because I know that you like to be out by 8:30, and I'm not going to talk over. But I do want to bring you up to date a little bit. I've gone along. I was, of course, wanted to become a movie star again, because just because I'm sober does not mean I'm going to let go of this idea, this fantasy life. And there's some things that I did that I really did enjoy. I took some singing lessons and some dancing lessons and some acting classes, and I enjoyed all of it. But one of the things that I feel very fortunate about is the way we read all this stuff over and over again in the meetings. And one time in the meeting when I was fairly newly sober, I heard, practice these principles in all of our affairs. And I thought, oh, hell, I bet that means that I have to behave myself at work. Now, this is not to say that I was really a horrible person at work. I showed up every day. I was honest. I was clean. I was nice to nice people. And I got along with my coworkers, whether they were nice or not, because I knew I had to. And I was respectful to my boss because I knew I had to be. So I knew what side my bread was buttered on. And I sort of had the feeling that perhaps, maybe, practices, principles in all of our affairs meant that I had to be willing to treat people that I didn't like so much in the restaurant the same way I was willing to treat people in Alcoholics Anonymous, to give them the benefit of the doubt. And I'm very grateful that I heard that and I started practicing on it. I tried very hard to become nice. I didn't realize that that's what I was doing, but that's really what it became, is that gradually over the years I became nice. Now, I don't always feel nice, and you can throw a rock anywhere in my group and hit somebody who has been offended by me at one time or another. But my goal is to be nice to people, and that in itself is a miracle of this fellowship and this program, because I, like I said earlier on, and I don't belabor it too much, because as you get older and older, I don't think anybody wants to hear this too much, but this need to be alluring, because I thought, if I just am universally alluring, then everything will be all right. And I found out that making an effort to be nice to people goes a lot farther than trying to allure them. And thank God, I as a matter of fact, a psychiatrist, not my favorite psychiatrist, but another psychiatrist once said to me, and this was after I was sober, I had never been very nice to this man, and I felt a little guilty. So I came over here one time with my mom, and I called him up, and I asked him if I could see him, and I took him out to lunch and tried to some extent to make amends as best I could. And I remember him looking me dead in the eye and saying, "What are you going to do when your allure fades, Miss King?" And I can assure you that it will fade. And I, at the time, I thought, you know, I didn't think anything of it. It registered, but that's all it did was register. And, you know, I got up there in my late 50s and stuff, and I'm thinking, thank God for a little character development, you know. I am very grateful for the fact that somehow or another it occurred to me to try to be nice to people, because it got to be easier and easier and easier. And as a result of that, the kind of work that I did for 40 years, which is wait table, was really not bad. I really didn't mind. I worked, you have a heart, in the early 90s, I came over here and helped open up the Hard Rock Cafe, not the hotel, but the Hard Rock Cafe. I worked for them for 16 years, and I used to be not only a trainer in the restaurant, but I used to go out on some when they'd open up a new restaurant, and I'd get to help open up. And it wasn't because I'm going to tell you something. You promise not to tell anybody else. I'm really not a particularly good waitress, but what I am is I can carry dishes, and I show up every day, and I remember what my station is, and I do my side work. But I am not. By a long shot, I'm not the best waitress in the world. And I also am not the biggest tip gatherer. People always say, "Oh, I bet everybody just throws money at you." No, I just made very average tips, but I made them every day. I showed up every day. I went to work every day. When we were busy, sometimes I wouldn't make that much more. But on average, day in and day out, I could always make a living. And it's because I became willing to be nice to people. Another thing that I tried real hard to do was not ever try to be the queen of the May. I never tried to lure customers into my station from other stations, or pick out the people that were the best tippers and try to lure them over to me, or fuss all over movie stars and let other people sit. I remember when I was a trainer, we'd have these big openings, and sometimes there would be kind of a celebrity turnout for these things. And quite often I'd be assigned to the people that were not the very best of the group, and also we'd have some of the quieter tables. And I can remember telling everybody, you know, and saying, "All right, you guys, remember, the movie stars come and go. These are going to be our customers. We have to remember to treat everybody as if they're very, very important, because trust me, they are. Believe me, nobody in the whoever wait, unless you're in some really big, big, famous place, nobody makes their living off movie stars. You make it off the people that come in and eat lunch with you day after day after day. That's where you make your money, and you make your money by being decent to people." And it made it a lot easier for me. I never resented waitressing. I always sort of wished I was a movie star, but I did not resent being a waitress. I enjoyed it. I don't do it anymore. I stopped in 2003. I'd had a job, and it kind of came to an end. And so I do a little part-time work now. I collect Social Security. I'm that age now, so I can collect Social Security. And I lead a pretty comfortable life. You know, there's that line. I go to it's time for me to quit. I go to a meeting where I go to a promises meeting, and we go over the promises. And there's one promise that they talk about: we will not regret the past or wish to shut the door on it. And one of the things that I have to be very much aware of, I have a lot more past here in Alcoholics Anonymous than I ever did. I've been sober a lot longer than I was alive, and so a lot of my past is taking place, you know, in sobriety. And so I look back on the years that I spent in sobriety, and I do not regret the past, nor do I wish to shut the door on it. This is who I am. I don't drink. I go to a lot of meetings. I have a sponsor. I sponsor people. I take an interest. I show up, and I have commitments at meetings. I'm the I'm the commitment lady at the Sunday morning meeting, and I get there at 7 o'clock in the morning, and the meeting that meets there the night before is not part of our group. It's another group in West L.A. And they don't always clean up after themselves, and the neighbors don't know the difference. So they come over to us and ask us. So every Sunday morning at 7 o'clock, I'm out there with rubber gloves and a paper bag picking up refuse from that meeting, and sometimes I even pick up stuff that I don't think is AA dropped. I just pick it up. So I help clean up the neighborhood a little bit. And, you know, as a result of that, I lead a pretty good life. I've been able to be of some service to my mother, who is old and kind of scared now, and I've been able to be a good daughter to her. I was a good daughter to my dad. They came and visited me. I was able to make up to them for some of the heartache that I know that they had. I've had a good life, and I hope that I'm going to have a good life for a lot longer. I've enjoyed very much being here tonight, and thank you.